All right, is everyone back from the cigarette break? Okay, good. All right, we ended right at the end of the third step, where it talked about our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. Therefore, here it is, the second paragraph on 64, therefore we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. Now, Bill's going to go on to tell us about a commercial inventory of a business, and then he's going to roll right into what we need to be doing as far as inventorying our lives to find out the causes and conditions that made us alcoholics, that made us drink, that made us do the things that we did. Okay? A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. Is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about the values. So if I'm going to be successful, I have to put down on paper, it's going to tell me exactly what I've done, why I've done it, and what I should do about it. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failures. Being convinced that self, manifested in various ways was what had defeated us. We considered its common manifestations, okay? And we're going to start with the first one. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stems all forms of spiritual disease, for we have been not only mentally and physically ill, remember Dr. Silkworth, the obsession of the mind, the allergy of the body. We have been spiritually sick. Now here it is. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. So what we have to do is we have to get right first with the God of our understanding. We have to overcome our spiritual malady, our spiritual sickness, which each one of us has when we come in here. It's not a twofold illness, it's really a threefold illness. Dr. Silkworth knew about the two part, the obsession and the allergy. Carl Jung knew about the other part, spirituality, to overcome a complete psychic change, to have a complete psychic change. And Bill put all three of them together when he was writing this. So we have to overcome the spiritual malady, and then we straighten out mentally and physically. In dealing with resentment, we set them on paper. Okay, he's going to tell us a couple different times why we should write things down. We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. Column 1, I'm resentful at, and then I list those people. And when you make a list, it's kind of like going to the grocery store. I heard a guy say one time, you don't write across when you go to the grocery store and you write down a list for things you're going to get. You write down. And so what you should do, humbly I'm saying, is you should write down column 1 first. Alright? We listed people, institutions, and principles with whom we were angry. Column 2. We ask ourselves why we were angry. What did they do to cause me to be angry? In most cases, we found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambition, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. That's column 3. What did it affect? How did it affect us? Was it my security? Was it my personal ambition? Was it my sex relations which have been hurt? On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries, and that's what I just went over, the self-esteem, security, ambition, personal relations, We were usually as definite as this example. Now, Bill is going to use a three-column example. When you continue read through here, you'll find out that there's really like five columns. All right? I'm resentful at the cause, it affects, where was I to blame, and where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, inconsiderate? What character defects caused me to do what I did? So he writes down, I'm resentful at Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, my employer, my wife. And then he goes through the cause. His attention to my wife, Mr. Brown. Told my wife about my mistress. Brown may get my job at the office. And that is where you're going to say, what does it affect? Now that affects his sex relationship because of his attention to his wife and about his mistress, his self-esteem, and his self-esteem and security when he's talking about his job. Now, there are three words that are bracketed after that, and there are going to be another three words bracketed after a couple of more of these, and we'll get to that in a minute. Mrs. Jones, she's a nut. She snubbed me. Well, why would she snub him? Well, probably because he has a mistress. She committed her husband for drinking. He's my friend. She's a gossip. Ever hear that before? He's a gossip. She's a gossip. I think Dr. Bob is the one who said gossip hurts everybody involved. My employer. Next to Mr. Jones, his personal relationship and his self-esteem. Next to his employer, he's unreasonable, unjust, overbearing. All employers are unreasonable, unjust, overbearing, right? He threatens to fire me for drinking and for padding my expense account. Well, if you're drinking on the job and you're stealing money from the company, why wouldn't you be fired? And Bill writes that his self-esteem and security were threatened. And then his wife, she misunderstands and nags. She likes Brown. She wants the house put in her name. Goodness gracious, it looks like this person is going to lose his wife, his mistress, his job, and his house just in four different columns. And about his wife, it affects his pride, his personal and sex relations, and his security. And that word I was talking about that's bracketed is called fear. And we're going to read about fear in just a second. It says, we went back through our lives and nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. The first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. Really? To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. The alcoholics. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse, and then we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. So it's plain to see, it is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. And isn't that true? Isn't it true when you're sitting around just resentful, just hating something or somebody, how your mind is so focused on that and it can't allow anything else in, how you're blocked off from everything else around you, how when I'm driving into work and somebody cuts me off, I can be so resentful at them the whole day that I can't get anything done? And he goes on to say, to the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? It's exactly what I'm talking about. That I'm sitting there focused on that person cutting me off all day long, wanting to go back and wreck his car, you know, and I don't get any work done. Because I'm just squandering away the hours that would have been worthwhile. But with the alcoholic, and this is very important here, listen. But with the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. we found that it is fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die. Continually talks about how this disease is one deadly thing if we don't get rid of these defects of characters and get this spiritual experience. Bob summed it up pretty easily when he said, you know, the program should be just broken down into trust God, clean house, help others. And trust God's the first three step. Clean house is 4 through 11. Help others is 12. With us, to drink is to die. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for the alcoholic, these things are poison. Okay? And it says, we turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, made up or real, had the power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. Okay, this was our course. We realized that people who had wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. And this is where we're going to get into what we call the sick man prayer or the resentment prayer. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way they disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. We asked God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended us, we said to ourselves, "This is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him or her? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done." That's what we need to be learning to do. It's hard sometimes, but the more you practice it, the more you study it, the more you do it, the easier it becomes. Because we cannot get involved in what we're going to talk about next. We avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. Okay, back referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done. Now, people talk about, well, we have to disregard the other person's part. And we don't look at their part. It doesn't talk about part in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't talk about looking at anybody else. This is our inventory, remember? And so we put out of our minds the wrongs others had done. We don't even think about them. We look at our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? That is where column 5 comes in. Though a situation has not been entirely our fault, we try to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly and were willing to set these matters straight. Now that's forgiving. Forgiving, if other people have wronged us, we make such a big deal out of it that it blows up in our face. So what we have to do is look at what we did, look at our defects, and we have to be willing to set the matter straight. And again it says, we admitted our wrongs honestly. Honestly, 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 this is a program of honest action. Now, remember the word that was next to those self-esteem and personal ambitions and everything that was affected? It was the word fear. And it says now, notice the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. Fear. Fear touches almost every aspect of my life when I first got here. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstance which brought us misfortunes we felt we didn't deserve. We felt we didn't deserve it. But did we not ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classified with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. It steals my state of mind. It steals my thought pattern. It steals my compassion. It steals everything that I want because I'm so afraid. And it's not even real. It's a fancied fear. And so on the next list, because we have four lists that we're talking about doing. The resentments, the next one's going to be fear. Who or what do I fear? The cause? What's it affect? What part of self have I been relying on which has failed me? And what did I do? So we reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper. Even though we had no resentments in connection with them, we asked ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance had failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it only was worse. You know, when you think about it, when you think about the fear, there is a normal fight or flight fear put in us by God. It is normal to have real fear. But as an alcoholic, I imagined fear all the time. I projected what was going to happen tomorrow, a week from tomorrow, a month from tomorrow, and it was always going to be bad news. No matter how good I did at my job, it was never going to be good enough tomorrow. And so my projections, and this is what I was told real early on in my sobriety working with my sponsor. My projections almost always wrong. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I don't know what's going to happen next week or next month. I don't know if I'm going to wake up tomorrow. So what I have to do is I have to look at today. I have to keep my feet firmly planted in sobriety of today and not be projecting. So the next paragraph, it says, perhaps there is a better way. We think so. For we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. Step 3. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role He assigns just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him does He enable us to match calamity with serenity. So if I'm relying on God in all my affairs, forget the drinking. Drinking was just a symptom, remember? It was just a part. But now if I'm relying on God in all my affairs, He allows me to match calamity with serenity. You know, my little brother, I held his hand when he died, and that was calamity. But because I was relying on God, I didn't have to get freaked out about it. I didn't have to go running around crazy. I didn't have to do all these things that I would have been doing if I was drunk. Because I had serenity. I knew that God had taken my little brother away from the pain that he was in. The same goes for when I found my older brother, just about a year ago. It was horrible at first. But the first thing I did after I called for the sheriffs to come out was I called my sponsor. And the calamity of the situation, I had serenity knowing that God had taken my older brother for whatever reason, I didn't have to drink or drug over it. I didn't have to go running around crazy about it. I had serenity because I trust God in all my affairs. Not just my drinking affairs. I trust Him in all my affairs. And he goes on to say that we never apologize to anyone for depending on our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage, and all men of faith have courage. They trust their God. So we never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. Not me telling you what God's done for me, but follow me around. That's the true essence of this program, is can you follow me around all day and can you watch what I do? I'm not perfect. Nobody's perfect. There was one carpenter that was perfect, but I was not perfect. And I'm not perfect today. But it's progress. And today, I'm better than I was a year ago in handling situations. And today, I try to let my actions show people what this program's done for me. I try to let God demonstrate through me what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. Alright, so you have five columns for your fear reviews. Now you're going to have five columns about your sex, because the next paragraph says, now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there. I certainly did. But above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get off the track. Here we found human opinions running to the extremes. Absurd extreme, perhaps. One set of voices cries that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessary of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex. That was my voice. Who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind. They see the significance everywhere. Now, when I have my five columns here, I review my conduct over the past years. Who did I hurt? What did I do? What feelings did I create in others? Where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate? And what should I have done instead? One school will allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. And this is where they really just said to themselves, we need to let each individual person work that out with God. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbitrator of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? Well, we reviewed our conduct over the past years. Next column, where have we been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Who did we hurt? Did we unjustly arouse suspicion, jealousy, bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? Again, we got this down on paper and we looked at it. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We asked God to mold our ideas and help us live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed, and I've got nor misunderstood. We ask God to mold our ideas and to help us live up to them. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow towards it. We must be willing to make amends where we've done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in doing so. Step 9. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, step 11, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. If we want it and we're relying on God through our third step, then we will get the right answer. God alone can judge our sex situation. Nobody else has the right to judge it. Not even me. God alone can judge it. And he goes on to say, counsel with persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. You know, I have guys come to me all the time and want advice. And I tell them, let's look for it in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only advice I have. I can't give advice on financial matters, on relationship matters. I don't have that capability. I have the capability of going back to the book and studying with them exactly where it is. Is it safe? Is it sound? Is it what you want? Is it God-given? Have you prayed about it? Now, in step 4 and 5, the first 100 are going to tell us a couple times what possibly might make us drink. Resentment, if we hold on to them, we might drink. We're in the sex inventory. Suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Top of page 70, second paragraph. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so. But this is only a half truth. It depends on us and our motives. If we are truly sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven and we will have learned our lesson. Here it comes. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are the facts out of our experience. So they have experienced this. They have watched this over and over in the 3.5 years from the time they started meeting to the time that they wrote this book. They watched over and over that when people were just free and loose and didn't care about who they harmed, that they invariably got drunk again. And for us to drink is to die. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. All right? If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the impervious urge when to yield would mean heartache. Each one of us probably has personal experience with being in love with somebody and then losing that person in their life. Okay? And each one of us probably, at one time or another, yielded to an unhealthy sexual attitude, either having a mistress or going around a girlfriend's back or something like that. And this is for girls as well as guys. And invariably, we were drinking. Now that we're not drinking, and now that we know that drinking was just a symptom, we need to straighten out not only our resentments, our angers, our sex, but any other harms that we've caused others, any other thing we did to harm others. If we have been thorough about our personal inventory, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. We have begun to comprehend their futility and fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill towards all men, even our enemies. For we look on them as sick people. We have listed the people we have hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can, without doing other harms. 8 and 9. In this book you will read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced that God now can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you've already made a decision, step 3, and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, step 4, you've made a good beginning. That being so, you swallowed and digested some big truths, big chunks of truth about yourself. I was thinking about stopping there, but I think I'm going to go on another couple pages. Into action, chapter 6. Now, remember, the first 5 chapters, almost, first 4.5 chapters, were dedicated to the problem and the solution. Step 1, step 2. The problem and the solution. Bill was trying to get people to understand that entirely, all the way up to the end of the ABCs. And then he said, being convinced, we're now at step 3. So, step 3 and step 4 are in chapter 5. Now, chapter 6, into action, a program of action, a design for living. This chapter alone contains steps 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. This chapter alone contains all those steps because we are convinced that we have a problem. We have made a decision by being convinced that there is a solution, a spiritual awakening, a spiritual experience, a change in the way we do, act, or think. Having made our personal inventory, into action, having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We've been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and discover the obstacles in our path. We have admitted certain defects. We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. This requires action on our part, which when completed will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. This brings us to the 5th step of the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter. Program of recovery requires action on our part. Now it's easy for me to stand back and say, well, okay, I've written down my shortcomings, I've written down my fears, my sex conduct, my resentments, my harms to others. So I know them. And God knows them. Why I gotta go tell somebody else? Why can't I just move on with the program without having to admit them to somebody else? Because the confessions of my shortcoming to another human being is what is the freeing part of this 5th step. It says that this is perhaps difficult, even discussing our defects with another, especially discussing our defects with another person. We think we've done well enough in admitting these things to ourselves. There is doubt about that. In actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. Many of us thought it necessary to go much further. We'll be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reasons why we should do so. The best reason first. If we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. It says in the end of the sex inventory, if we continue to harm other people and we're not sorry and we're not asking for forgiveness, we're sure to drink. They weren't theorizing. If we skip this vital step, vital being life-giving step, we may not overcome our drinking. So they're telling me that I have to discuss this with somebody else. Time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives. Ever heard that his secrets will kill you? Trying to avoid this humbling experience, they have turned to easier methods. What happened? Almost invariably, they got drunk. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wonder why they fell. We think the reason is they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory all right, but they hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves. But they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense we find it necessary until they told someone else all their life story. Now, when I was first writing my inventory, I was writing it from the time I got drunk the first time to the time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I thought I was supposed to be doing. And then when I read the word all my life story, I realized that I had to go back before I started drinking. And I had to tell somebody about what I did before I turned 11 and had my first drink. That when I was 10 years old, that a friend of mine got bit by a little mouse on the way home from school, and he took it home with him, and his mother called my mother. We were on an Air Force base, and my mother asked me if I got bit, and I didn't like school, and I thought I was going to get out of school. And I said, yes, I did. Even though I had no scratch marks or no bite marks on me anywhere, I lied. And instead of getting out of school, some of you know my story, I wound up getting rabies shots. Simply because I was lying. When I thought back when I was 7 years old and lived at Yokota Air Force Base in Japan, some of us decided we wanted to roast some marshmallows across the street. Nobody was around. We got up some dry grass. Somebody went and got some coat hangers. Somebody went and got the marshmallows. I, of course, went and got the matches. We lit that little pile of dried grass, and the entire field caught on fire, just like that. And all of us ran in different directions to our house. I ran into my house, I picked up the phone, somebody answered it, and I yelled, fire, and I hung it up. I was 7 years old. I had no clue that on a military base, when you pick up the phone, somebody answers it, they know where the call's coming from. So everybody knew exactly who called. And when my dad got home, he said, Jim, did you start the fire across the street? And I said, no, sir. And he knew I was lying. So before I had a drink, I was full of lying, cheating, and stealing. So alcohol didn't make me do that. I realized when I told somebody all my life story. It goes on to say, more than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He is very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents his stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but he knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. That was me, the big shotism. I wanted everybody to see how great I was. And inside, I didn't feel great at all. I was just trying to put on a show. The inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on his sprees. My sprees were continually. I mean, I didn't drink in the morning, I told you, and I didn't drink in the afternoon. I didn't drink with clients. But my goal was to make it through the day so I could start drinking for the effect produced by alcohol and get drunk. I was not looking for social drinking ever. I wanted that ultimate feeling that most alcoholics have. I want to be hammered. And one of the things that I did so many times was in a blackout. I'd come to and people would tell me what I did, and I was like, you're full of junk. You know, there's no way I could have done something as stupid as that. There's no way. And then I remembered one time I was sitting in the living room with a girl that I had thought I might want to marry, and her parents were visiting from overseas, and I had gotten so drunk that in mid-conversation, apparently I had passed out. And when I came to the next morning, sitting in the chair, everybody had gone to bed, my friend told me what had happened. That I just, in mid-conversation, I just blacked completely out. And I said, no way. And then he showed me a picture he had taken with a Polaroid camera, he had placed a 50-pound bag of dog food in my lap and taken a picture of me, and then took the dog food off my lap and then showed me the picture the next day. And I was appalled. And of course, that girl never married me. I'm friends with her parents, but I don't see them very often. But boy, I don't forget that. I don't forget that. He trembles to think that someone might have observed him. Of course, somebody did and took a picture. But then, as fast as he can, he pushes these memories far inside himself. He hopes he'll never see the light of day. He is under constant fear and tension, and makes for more drinking. Of course it does. Psychologists are inclined to agree with us. We have spent thousands of dollars for examinations. We know but few instances where we've given these doctors a fair break. We spend $175 an hour to talk about ourselves to a doctor, and when they ask us, well, how much do you drink? Oh, just a couple here and there. But we're spending all that time, effort, and money for somebody to listen to our lies. We have seldom told them the whole truth, nor have we followed their advice. So when we did tell them the truth, and they said, well, you've got an alcohol problem, you probably need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a lot cheaper than $175 an hour. But we didn't follow their advice. Unwilling to be honest with these sympathetic men, we were honest with no one else. Small wonder many in the medical profession have a low opinion of alcoholics and their chance of recovery. We must be entirely honest with somebody if we expect to live a long and happy in this world. Rightly and naturally, we think well before we choose the person or persons with whom to take this intimate and confidential step. I've heard many times people pick a sponsor, they give them the most intimate details of their sex conduct, their fears, their resentment, and then those sponsors wind up either making fun of them at a poker game or a bridge party or a ladies' party, and telling their four-step inventory to somebody else. So when it says we think well before we choose the person to take this intimate and confidential step. Those of us belonging to a religious denomination which requires confession must, and of course, will want to go to the properly appointed authority whose duty it is to receive it. Confession. Though we have no religious connection, we may still do well to talk with someone ordained by established religion. They just are not supposed to tell anybody what we say. They're not supposed to. Alcoholics Anonymous is full of priests, pastors, nuns, and they found a spiritual way of life that they couldn't find in their own religion. Or they rediscovered it by not having to drink. We often find such a person quick to see and understand our problems. Of course, we sometimes encounter people who do not understand alcoholics. Most non-alcoholics don't understand us. It goes on to say, and this will be the last paragraph I read, if we cannot or would rather not do this, we search, and that's talking about not doing the step, but not doing it to somebody ordained. We search our acquaintances or a closed-mouth, understanding friend. They don't talk about sponsorship in the big book like they do in the 12 and 12. But that's what we're talking about here. A closed mouth, understanding friend. We might talk to our doctor or psychologist. We'll be there in person. We'll be the person. It may be one of our own family. I don't think so. But it may be one of our own family, they say. But we cannot disclose anything to our wives or our parents which will hurt them or make them unhappy. And I go on to say, and our sons and our daughters and our brothers and our sisters, I just don't recommend that my guys do that with family members. It's best for me to do it with my sponsor, so my sponsor can help me later on when I'm writing my eighth and doing my ninth step. I feel they need to know these things. We have no right to save our skin at another person's expense. Such parts of our stories we tell to someone who will understand yet be unaffected. The rule is, We must be hard on ourselves, but always considerate of others. Hard on ourselves, but always considerate of others. Okay, next week we're going to pick up with the last paragraph on page 74. We're going to continue in step 5. And we're getting into action. We're going to start moving along quick, because this program needs to be done, and it needs to be done not in a hurried manner, but in a thorough, dedicated manner in which you don't sit around and take your time. This is not the easy do it place. This is to continue the action that's going to save your life. Okay, I'll see y'all next week. Thanks.